The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
This is KORC, News, Music, and Civics, heard every Sunday from 1 to 2 and repeated Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. on KORC 105.9 LPFM, Corvallis, Oregon. You can stream the station worldwide at korcfm.com, where you can also see our schedule of programs, can make a secure online contribution, and find an archive of past KORC News, Music, and Civics shows. This is Dan Kroll. I'm in the Southtown studio, joined by Wendy Byrne as we kick off 2025.
Yay, it's about time. I'm going to just pretend there's lots to look forward to this year, because why not? Then there is lots to look forward to.
Time marches on whether we like it or not.
That's right. And it's nice to see 2024 in the rearview mirror.
During 2024, Wendy Byrne came on board here at KORC and has been doing a lot of reporting, weekly reporting, on the city council and city issues. And we were just talking before we started recording about talking about other topics such as bicycle transportation and other things that we care about.
Right. Yeah. You know, transportation options as far as things that involve not driving my car has always been near and dear to my heart for lots of reasons. And it's still near and dear to my heart. I'm going to have a whole side hustle, I guess I might say, of working with a local organization on safe streets advocacy in Corvallis. And I, as much as I enjoy the Corvallis Civics Cafe thing that I've developed, that you've allowed me to develop here, and I plan to keep doing that, it'd be fun to also bring in some of the transportation-oriented stuff that I could share.
I would absolutely love that. And I should mention, we do have a new program on KORC now called Bicycles and Life, and its debut date was January 5th. Maybe you're listening on January 5th or January 6th if you're hearing our repeat on Monday. And it's a program about the bicycle as a political vehicle, as an agent of change, as viable transportation that can really reshape one's life.
Right. You know, it's interesting. There are some places that have included bicycle transportation options in their emergency, in their CERT programs, their local civic emergency response plans, because if there are certain problems with the on-street network, you can usually ride your bike around a lot of problem areas after a disaster that you may not be able to drive your car around.
And one thing I can say for Corvallis is, as much as we've seen fluctuations in some of the quality of life here, we do have a great bicycle infrastructure.
We've always had good bicycle infrastructure, and I believe we can continue to do better. But we've had, you know, it is one of the best places in Oregon to ride your bicycle, and I would like to see more people both aware of that and engage with that.
I must admit, I have become reliant on my fossil fuel vehicle, and it really is inspiring to see you, for instance, pretty much showing up everywhere KORC related on your bicycle.
Yes, it's my first choice for transportation.
We also have Trevor Held on our volunteer roster, and he is certainly he's iconic with his bicycle.
He is both because his bicycles are both beautiful and unique, and because he's such a incredibly pleasant individual, and it's great to be around Trevor any chance you get.
I would have to agree with that. And as we move forward into 2025, we do want to talk about issues that are near and dear to our heart, aside from just local politics or happenings with the city, the county, or the state. So we do appreciate having Wendy Byrne, as well as others in the community. And I should say, if you would like to be a part of what we're doing at KORC News, Music, and Civics, this is community radio. You don't have to be a well-seasoned journalist. Maybe you're just someone with a curious mind. You can get in touch with us. You can send an email to info@korcfm.com. And I know that Wendy has an email, wendy@korcfm.com. And if you would like to be in touch, maybe give some kind of news tips or story ideas I'm sure Wendy or any of us at info@korcfm.com would be open to your ideas.
Right. And if people have heard something or thought they maybe missed something or have some questions about anything I present or would like to hear more, it'd be great to hear from those people at those email addresses because we would like, I'd like to make sure to provide people with the information or the connections to the information that they seek. Because part of my involvement in this situation came from my frustration over the years of trying to find information. And don't burn daylight or don't waste time or spend time trying to learn how to find information. Reach out to the people who know how to find that information and then dive in.
And I know that you have created a public service announcement that has aired on KORC in the past, but why don't we go over again? If people want to just follow the city council and they don't have time to go to the meetings, there is a Vimeo channel, correct?
There is a Vimeo channel, and the fastest way to... So all the city council meetings and most city-related meetings are recorded and archived on Vimeo. Vimeo.com/City of Corvallis will get you to the homepage. And the videos are there chronologically, running from most recent and then into the past. And there's a lot of information there, maybe too much. But if you have a curiosity about what happened in a meeting, that's the fastest place to find it.
What kind of meetings are coming up in this early part of 2025?
We're kicking off this Monday, January 6th, with the first City Council meeting of 2025, and the very first thing that's going to happen at that meeting is the new councilors are going to get sworn in to their seats. So wards 3, 4, 6, and 8 all have new city councilors who will be taking their seats, and then they're going to launch right into their first meeting of the year. So they have a steep learning curve, but I'm confident they're ready.
And how many total councilors are there?
There are 9. There are 9 wards in Corvallis, and our city councilors are elected to serve in their wards. Some cities do it by region. We do it by wards. So 9 wards, 9 councilors, and of the 9 for this year, there are 4 new ones.
I know that I live in Southeast Corvallis, which is Ward 3. It is good for people to know their wards. Which ward do you live in?
I live in Ward 5. So your city councilor in Ward 3 is Jim Moorfield. He served as a city councilor approximately 30 years ago and has decided to run again. Really excited to hear more from Jim. I've met with him, and he has a great, what do we call it, institutional knowledge of city council. But then he's been busy in the private sector for a long time, and I think he has some really interesting ideas to bring to the table and to the city.
What about some of the other new councilors?
We have in Ward, so that was Jim Moorfield in Ward 3, and in Ward 4, since Gabe Shepard was elected to serve as a Benton County Commissioner, he's moving on, and Ava Olson has been elected to serve in Ward 4, and she is a current, I believe she's a current student at OSU, which is, since Ward 4 is right next to the university, and there are a lot of students that live in that ward, I think that's excellent representation for that ward, or should be. In Ward 6 is Allison Bowden. They're in tech and work for the school district and seem very knowledgeable about engaging their community in the city. I think that's a great choice for Ward 6. And then in Ward 8, Carolyn Mayers is going to be stepping in for Tracy Yee, who elected not to run again. And she's recently just been on the Planning Commission for a couple of years and has been a very engaged, very knowledgeable, does a lot of research, really is holds herself to a high standard for knowing what she's talking about when she's talking about things. So I think it's really great energy coming into City Council.
Do you feel like they have a number of challenges ahead?
I do. I think it's going to be interesting, just like, for example, starting right off at the beginning of the year, they're going to be diving into a land use case that has been sitting idle for approximately 18 years, which is called the Cascade Crest subdivision. And that is just something that is going to be maybe a little bit deep in the sort of understanding the legal ramifications of something that's and the land use, it's complicated, that. But then also on tap for very early in the year is a review of the city charter, which is important based on some problems that happened on city council last year and some ambiguity in our charter language that needs to be addressed and fixed so that we can move forward and that won't happen again.
And I think we should reiterate there, the city charter language has been held to a very high standard at some times, but it is not always followed, correct?
Well, yeah, I think that's one way of putting it. It's also just like the city charter language is, like a lot of things, I guess it depends on if you're an originalist or an interpreter of language, and it's sort of like, does the language mean exactly what it says it means, or is it open to interpretation?
It does seem like it has a lot of legalese and other, it's written poorly.
Right, and something that was written in 1943 with a certain perspective that maybe wasn't necessarily broadly defined or well-defined. We should fix that. We have as a city, we can amend our charter. The interesting thing, it will be the city council will decide what they want to do, and then their decisions will go to a vote of the people, because they can't just decide to change the charter. The charter changes have to be voted on by the city of Corvallis, by the people of the city of Corvallis.
Mm-hmm. While we're talking about the city charter, what is the latest on the whole Charlene Ellis situation? Because we do know that because of a supposed violation of the city charter language, it turned into a very expensive debacle for the taxpayers of Corvallis in legal fees, among other things.
Right. I was just discussing this timeline with somebody else this week, so it's sort of fresh on my mind. But there is this Charlene Ellis and her lawyer elected to sue the city of Corvallis based on what the city tried to remove Charlene from the council based on actions taken during a council meeting. And that lawsuit is just sitting idle, is my understanding. And based on the election that she ran for re-election, she won.
And that was Ward 5, right?
That was Ward 5, right. And so because she ran unopposed and she is well-liked in the ward, she had a very high rate of re-election, despite running unapproved. I mean, running unopposed, but easily was, people said, yes, please, we want you to remain our city councilor. So this whole thing about whether or not she violated the charter sort of becomes a moot point. So there has been very little action on this from the judge in Eugene, which is where the case is sitting on the desk of a judge in Eugene. And I have heard that there has been no action on it from either side. So what happens next? And the city of Corvallis has already spent likely, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars on this case. And is there some way to wrap it up so we can say it's gone and then change the charter so that it doesn't happen again?
Wouldn't it maybe behoove the city manager, the mayor, the city council to somehow figure out a way to resolve this without it costing Corvallis so much money?
Right. Any more money? Right. I believe my understanding is that if the city council wanted to do that, they could. The power lies in the hands of the city council. If the city council wanted as a body to make a decision to make this stop, go away, whatever is the language, I don't know the legal language to use for it. I don't have that background. They could. The city council has a lot of power. I think part of the problem with the city council is that the city council has been doesn't understand that. Maybe last year they might have felt nervous after what happened, and they probably didn't function as well as they could as a body to make a decision, make something happen, move forward.
And from my point of view as just a citizen, it would seem if this is supposed to be a progressive city that we would be focused on issues way different than this.
Right. This is a giant waste of time. One thing as I look at the charter and read the charter language, one thing that I don't think we have is a way for this to have something like this. If there was a perceived wrong, that there would be a way to do a censure instead of a removal. So, you know, the best thing that could be said from this whole situation is that it has illuminated problems with the charter. And as a progressive city, we should be happy to fix those things.
In addition to those legal costs that we just talked about, I know that there was a land use situation that came up late last year where it turns out that the city had been charging developers for land improvements that the developers didn't actually benefit from and now is going to be paying some of that money back.
Right. You know, that was in that particular case, there were some systems development charges that because of the position of that property on the map, the developer was charged fees for both sides of the property. And long story short is they should not have been charged those fees. And the city attorney at the time had recommended that those fees, that the city attorney said, yes, this is appropriate. As it turns out, it wasn't. Well, the city attorney has retired. That developer was smart enough to push the city on it, and now they're going to get their money back. And that opened, unfortunately, because of those mistakes, it opens up the door for other developers to come back and say, hey, was I overcharged? And the city might have to pay those fees back too. Haven't heard anything on that lately, but that is certainly something that will come up to haunt the city.
So realistically, if the city starts to go broke because of these kinds of things, what is that going to mean ultimately for life in Corvallis?
Well, you know, I guess that is a possibility. One thing that I've seen in Corvallis, at least when I've been trying to learn how to look at the budget and the finances of the city, is that we're fairly financially well run. Even though I know it's difficult for people to be always asked to pay more for things, there's very careful controls on the city's finances, we'll say. And so I don't think, and then there's always insurance. The city is insured. I think I've also heard, say, we were speaking about the Ellis situation in the lawsuit. It remains unclear to me if any of those lawyers' fees may be covered by the city's insurance. But see, that we don't. What doesn't seem to happen to me is there's been no discussion about that. I mean, there may be $200,000 in legal fees. Those may be covered by the city's insurance. Well, as we all know, when we make a claim on our insurance, then our rates go up. But at least there's probably some help in some of these situations where there may be assistance in payments from the insurance. But you could have a whole day, you could spend a whole day on talking about the problems with insurance and the expense of insurance and how a lot of things are going to be changing in our future because the insurance companies are all going to go bankrupt paying for the problems. But that's a whole nother discussion.
Well, like if you consider the insurance market in Florida, where they've just stopped paying for homes that got flooded out or hurricane damage or otherwise.
Or, you know, Oregon, California, being so close to us and knowing about the fires that have happened over the last couple of years, a lot of places, you know, should you get paid out to rebuild in a highly fire-prone area? I don't know. It's getting harder and harder to get homeowners insurance, and that has giant ripple effect across the country.
We're speaking with Wendy Byrne, who is the producer of the Civics Cafe segment every week here on KORC News, Music, and Civics. And we're just talking about, we're kind of looking back at 2024, but also looking ahead to 2025 and what kinds of things to look out for with the city council. Luckily, Wendy has it in her habit. She's already going to these meetings, which when are the city council meetings?
City council has what some may refer to as a business meeting every Monday, or if there's a holiday on a Monday, it's usually the following Tuesday. So, sorry, not every Monday. The first and third Mondays of the month, they have their business meeting, which is where they conduct formal business. On Thursdays, the first and third Thursdays of every month, they have a work session. And the work sessions are more casual, where they maybe get presentations from staff or other people about upcoming items that will be then on the business meetings in the future. And the Monday night meetings are from 6 till usually about 8 p.m. and are at the downtown Corvallis Fire Station, Fire Station number 1. And the Thursday meetings are in what's known as the Madison Avenue Meeting Room at the corner of 5th and Madison, right across from City Hall. And those are from 4 to 6 on Thursdays.
Folks can follow the City of Corvallis through Vimeo.
Correct. Vimeo.com/City of Corvallis will get you to the free archive of recordings of City Council meetings. the information that I have on deck for this coming Monday meeting is the new councilors will take their seats. They'll have some discussion of land use issues that might come up in the future, and then they will get their assignments, their liaison assignments for what committees the councilors are going to follow. And then on Thursday, they're going to start talking about something near and dear to me. At their work session, they're going to talk about some transportation improvements for bicycling and pedestrian infrastructure safety.
And we don't currently have a bicycle pedestrian advisory committee. We used to, but we don't currently, correct?
Correct. Yeah, that sunset with a lot of board restructuring that happened in 2020. And that was a whole process that I think it was pretty well done. However, it left a vacuum for those of us that are concerned with bicycling and pedestrianing issues around the city. However, starting in January, there's a new task force called the Safe Streets and Roads for All Task Force. It's going to be about 18 months long. It's going to start meeting. I believe I'm actually was appointed to the task force, which is exciting for me. And it's going to meet, our first meeting is the 8th, so next week. And it's going to meet once a month to discuss developing a Safe Streets and Roads for All plan, which the City of Corvallis won a large federal grant to work on this plan. So I think they got $600,000 from the federal government to work on developing data so that when we can identify dangerous intersections, dangerous locations in the city for all modes of travel, and then come up with a plan for how to address that.
And if you visit the website transportation.gov, one could learn more about this program?
Yeah, this Safe Streets and Roads for All program was developed by the U.S. Department of Transportation and the Federal Highway Administration in response to the sort of meteoric rise of roadway-related tragedies, both for driving, for walking, for cycling. That's ever since COVID, really, there's been a massive spike in crashes and collisions the federal government is trying to say, what can we do to reverse this trend? And so they've been very generous in creating grants for cities that are willing to start addressing this. And I'm excited for Corvallis to see this program move forward.
I am someone who used to be a very regular cyclist, and I'm going to commit to riding my bike more in 2025.
That's great. And I'm hoping to get involved in maybe creating some radio spots here for KORC to help people who are bicycle curious. You know, you don't have to wear Lycra to ride your bike. You can just pull on a pair of rain pants in weather like this over your blue jeans and get out there and do things. And if people have questions or if people want to do that, we should have the network available for them to do it. But it also is nice to know, like, how do you do that? So I would love to have another program where I can talk to people about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's good if you are in the habit of riding your bike to be comfortable with it, because truly a bicycle should not be a burden. I mean, if you have your tire PSI at exactly where it needs to be, according to what you can see on the walls of your tire, it'll tell you the PSI limit. I mean, I found every 2 weeks I have to pump up my tires to the proper PSI, but also having lights, having a comfortable helmet, the seat at the right height, that is so important. Sometimes you see people riding around with their knees hitting their elbows. That's not the right seat height. There's all kinds of ways to really make the bicycle work for you to where it should not feel like a burden. You should look forward to getting on your bike.
Right. And in Corvallis, we have the Corvallis Bicycle Collective at 711 Northwest 11th Street, where you can go in and buy used bicycle equipment, used bicycle clothing. You can get free advice on how to fix your bike. You can even use a work stand. It is a community-run, donor-supported bike shop, and it is a wonderful resource for Corvallis, both for the bikes, for the information, and for bicycling-related racks, fenders, rain gear, panniers, all kinds of things. And it's a great centrally located community bike shop.
I love that place, and I've been able to get bicycles there for very reasonable prices.
They even have there are bicycles there that you could essentially get for free if you're willing to put them together yourself.
And on the flip side of that, bicycle shops in town are closing, like Bike and Hike, going out of business. Corvallis Cyclery is still there.
But, you know, the little bit of good news there is that Raj from Bike and Hike is going to be opening up his own shop on 6th. And I believe it's Adams, right there where Ball Studios and the camera shop used
to be. Yeah, yeah, right. By the train tracks.
Right. Here, I heard that in January he's going to open a small shop. He's going to focus on maintenance and repair for people. And I love that. I love that he's going to give it a go because his bike shops have been closing. And it's not an easy time to be a bicycle shop, a retailer in our buy it all online world.
Sometimes shelling out several $100 for a bike feels out of place for a lot of people.
Sure. I mean, granted, you can buy a used bike for a very reasonable amount, but you will still need to buy some new things for it to make it run properly and safely.
Well, I'm all for us talking more about bicycles in this coming year during this hour on KORC News, Music, and Civics, because even though a lot of folks might be listening in their car, it's always good inspiration to consider getting on the bike and catch our show that we are running and catch the show that we are running Sunday mornings, or I guess you could say Sundays at noon, Bicycles and Life, a new program that we're running on KORC.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to hearing that. I'm going to listen every week.
And as far as next week goes, next week on KORC News, Music, and Civics, I take it that you, Wendy Byrne, will have a report on this upcoming council meeting.
Yes, yes, indeed. I look forward to having some information to share with everybody about the two city council meetings this week.
Well, we look forward to it. And we do appreciate your weekly contributions to this program.
It's been a real fun. It's been a boost of confidence for me to learn how to share information with people. And it's been a real pleasure for me to get involved. Thanks. I appreciate it.
For sure. Well, it's been a pleasure to hear your reports. And there has always been a part of me, especially since I've lived in Corvallis, that I've wanted to be tied in with knowing what's going on locally. I've shown up to city council meetings throughout the years. I remember showing up to a city council meeting when it was a land use approval and the city council completely ignored the public testimony. And I just kind of gave up. I thought, what's the point? This is a very boring setting. And even though dozens upon dozens of people said, you know, don't develop on Grand Oaks, like the city council unanimously ignored that. And I just thought, screw these guys.
Right. You know, and the interesting thing, not to drag this out, but the night that the city council is making their final decision, if you're showing up on a Monday night to give testimony, it's probably too late.
I think that's when I did show up.
Right, and that's usually when I used to show up, right? And I think that's part of what I want to help people learn, is that if you have something that you're concerned about, you need to know at the work session when they're learning about it, which is the Thursday thing where nobody shows up because everybody's at work because it's from 4 to 6. Or you need to know to get your letters in a couple weeks before that, or maybe, you know, and that information is on the city 3-month calendar sometimes, but that's buried at the bottom of the city webpage. So these are the things I'm trying to talk about in the show, how to find this information, how to be aware of what's coming so that you don't find yourself frustrated at the meeting. They do hear you. I mean, they do care. They are already to the point where they have to make a decision. And so the decision is usually already made at that point. And it's great to be passionate, and it's great to take your thoughts and your feelings to city council, but it is also important to do it earlier in the process. So if I can help people do that, that's my goal.
We certainly do appreciate that bit of knowledge, because in today's day and age, sometimes keeping on top of every detail, well, it's impossible.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a good year for people to maybe spend a little less time on national politics and spend a little more time on local politics.
Already the national political scene, any bit I read from it, it's stranger than fiction.
It is stranger than fiction.
Wendy Byrne, thanks for your time today. And thank you to those of you out in the listening audience for tuning in to KORC News, Music, and Civics. We do appreciate the fact that you are tuned into your community enough to listen to our program. And Wendy, we definitely look forward to your report on the council meeting next week.
Great. Yeah. And for folks who are listening, do us all a favor and share this with your friends and let them listen too, because the more the better.
That's how a community happens.
All right. Thanks, y'all.
This is KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Kroll in the Southtown studio with Wendy Byrne.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. The following story is from the Gazette Times, dated December 28, 2024, and is authored by Alex Powers. Headline: North Corvallis Courthouse Stalled Again. Who is responsible for holding up construction of a nearly $90 million courthouse in Benton County? It appears officials at Benton County and Corvallis are pointing the finger at each other. Delays could add millions more in potential lost funding and legal liability to Benton County's replacement for its historic and iconic courthouse in downtown. Assistant Administrator Rick Krager told elected officials earlier in December that he was, quote, getting a little bit antsy, unquote, as the project's groundbreaking now approaches February. It's been pushed back at least three times. Krager said, "We know there's a lot riding on this. So what's the holdup? In a word, infrastructure." Krager said he believes the city must seek permission from Benton County and a private owner to access sewer lines proposed at the edge of neighboring properties in North Corvallis. He said, "It now feels like it has to be done before we can move forward on our permits." But the city staffers responsible for signing off on building plans can't until Benton County proves it has the permission for its construction to encroach on private property. That means it's up to Benton County, not Corvallis, and its neighbor to sign an agreement, said City Engineer Jeff McConnell. "They have lots of permits they need to show us," McConnell said. Corvallis is reviewing a proposed three-story courthouse and district attorney's office on a 20,500-foot footprint. Because Benton County plans to build inside city limits, its proposal has to meet the same city and state requirements that Corvallis requires to sanction any construction. The larger a proposed building, or the closer it is to waterways like streams and rivers, or the more it would impose on wetlands and infrastructure at the urban fringe, the more documentation an applicant has to show. "It's a unique site," McConnell said. Benton County already has some of those. Permits from the city to demolish an almost 140-year-old farmhouse and a detached garage, for example, and detailed plans to stop construction equipment from kicking up too much soil so that it would muddy the nearby Willamette River. The county is still waiting on others, like a permit from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers allowing Benton County to work around wetlands. The new courthouse property used to be the neighboring property. Elected officials envisioned a centralized campus for the government's criminal justice system, starting with the structure that will take over for the nearly 136-year-old Benton County Courthouse, which they say is likely to collapse in an earthquake. Tim McFadden did not accept the county's $5.48 million offer for the property. So Benton County sued under Oregon's takings law in 2022 to carve out nearly 30 acres of farmland off Highway 20, held under the owner's family name, McFadden Ranch. A circuit court judge in Lane County said that that was too much and ordered Benton County in June to give back almost 9 acres. Benton County agreed to pay McFadden more than $6 million for a smaller property to settle the case. Also in her ruling, Judge Deborah Velour stipulated that McFadden would allow the city to install pipes and a road on his property, reflecting terms in his settlement with the county. Access would be granted in an easement, 10 feet on Benton County's side and 10 feet on McFadden's, following the property line. Velour said in the ruling, "McFadden Ranch shall convey sanitary sewer easements and access easements to Benton County or to the city of Corvallis." The easements were to follow plans filed in the court and with Corvallis's planning department, but will ultimately be in a form deemed acceptable to the city of Corvallis, Velour said. Kreger and commissioners at the December 10th meeting indicated that the settlement, enshrined in Valeur's stipulated judgment, amounts to an agreement. Benton County's building department planned in 2023 for contractors to begin building during the summer of 2024. The local government then intended to start as soon as possible, by the end of 2024, to expend the $25 million in state funding granted through the Oregon Judicial Department. Oregon gave the county until June 2025 in a use-it-or-lose-it funding deal. Benton County took time-sensitive bids for the job over the summer, with construction slated to end 2 years later in the summer of 2026. Kreger said, "Those are expiring, so we have a potential cost issue." Corvallis' McConnell said the court case may have ordered that McFadden provide access, but it didn't generate the document conveying that access to Corvallis. "Before I can put a sewer pipe across the property, I need an easement," he said. City planners have sought the easement agreement since January 19th of 2024. They said in the first 3 of 6 plan reviews that the county applicant would have to provide evidence of an agreement in its application. They said in their latest review, issued December 24th and mailed to Portland-based design firm DLR Group, that Benton County still hadn't provided the document granting an easement. Regardless of the approach to resolution, this comment will remain unresolved until the applicant provides evidence and authorization for the proposed encroachments on abutting properties. That was a story in the Corvallis Gazette Times, dated December 28th of 2024, and was authored by Alex Powers. You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics.
This is Marge Pop for Community Voices on KORC. This article appeared as an As I See It editorial in the December 31st, 2024 issue of the Corvallis Gazette Times newspaper under the title Benton County Obscures Process. My preferred title, which was not used for publication, was a bit more direct. My suggestion was, Benton County persists in non-transparency. Republic Service has once again applied for a conditional use permit, CUP, to expand Coffin Butte Landfill. Expansion of Benton County's leading source of greenhouse gases is a very bad deal for our community, but highly profitable for Republic Services. On December 11th, Benton County met with Republic Services in a meeting, the substance of which has not been divulged to residents. No elucidating details of deficiencies found in Republic's application, nor their response, have been forthcoming, not through want of questioning. We have repeatedly requested more detailed information, but to no avail. A public records request to access some of the public information surrounding this process was denied with the startling claim, "County is not the custodian of the requested records." Further inquiry yielded this response from the county attorney regarding the planning consultant hired by the county. He says, 1, Winterbrook is not subject to public records request, and it has declined to provide confidential communications to Benton County. And 2, even if it were a public body, its communications through Republic's attorney would be exempt from disclosure. This response elicits so many questions. Was no member of county staff copied on these discussions between Republic's lawyer and the consultant? Is a document subject to legal privilege if it is not specifically designated so? Why did the county enter into a contract with a consultant who hides pertinent information from us? And perhaps the biggest question, why is our county attorney using his legal ledger domain to distance residents from information rather than obtaining it for us? There is much to question in Benton County's relationship to Republic Services. The Benton County Talks Trash, BCTT, workgroup convened after Republic's failed 2021 CUP application details virtually non-existent county supervision of this multi-million dollar environmentally destructive facility. Prior CUP conditions of approval are being ignored by Republic. Our county franchise payments are based on Republic's self-reported, unaudited statistics. Our county code enshrines what our county attorney characterizes as a monopoly for Republic. This code travesty was pointed out in 2022. Why hasn't it been fixed? Fees for residents who wish to appeal a Coffin Butte landfill expansion have quadrupled and are now open-ended with respect to passing on the county's unaudited costs. This is true only for landfill expansion processes. Other land use actions are unaffected. One of the prime BCTT recommendations was to improve transparency in the CUP process by providing timely notification and public access to meetings with Republic Services. Commissioners paid much lip service to greater transparency in the months following the BCTT process. However, we are now well into the 2024 CUP process, and the public notification and involvement process is still broken. The Benton County website is in continual flux, while outdated and inaccurate information is still present on the community development web pages. The promise of proactive public involvement has been completely sidelined. Notice of and access to meetings, recordings, and minutes of discussions with Republic Services have been non-existent. Residents must send a strong message to our county leadership demanding that they act in accordance with adopted values and the ethics of transparent government, environmental protection, and vibrant health for all. To learn more, visit the CoffinButteFacts.org website. Begin preparation now to speak out against the expansion of this uniquely damaging local facility. Our best hope of preserving our American democracy is to become actively involved in our local community. Let's begin 2025 with an effort to foster equity. Let's support our universal goal of a healthier planet for organic life on Earth by opposing this expansion attempt. Again, I want to repeat the title of the website that Benton County residents have established to inform local citizenry regarding the dangers that the Coffin Butte landfill poses to our community. And that is CoffinButteFacts.org. That's one word, CoffinButteFacts.org. This is Marge Pop for Community Voices on KORC. Thank you.
music by local musician Stephen Mankel, his project Merkel Music. That track is called Where's My Coffee? This is KORC News, Music, and Civics. You can hear this program every Sunday from 1 to 2 p.m., repeated Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. You can check the archive at our website, korcfm.com.
The more you listen to your kids, the closer you'll be. So we asked kids, what do you want your parents to hear?
I feel sometimes that I'm not listened to. I would just want you to listen to me more often and evaluate situations with me and lead me towards success.
We're not adults, so just be there and, like, listen. I just want someone to yap to. And I just feel like I'll be fine, like, if someone just hears me talk and talk and talk and talk and talk and talk and talk.
You're doing a really good job. And I don't think I tell you that enough. And I know sometimes we get into it and it's just hard on both of us. But, you know, try to understand me more and I'll try to do the same.
Listening is a form of love. Find resources to help you support your kids and their emotional well-being at soundedouttogether.org. That's soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and Pivotal.
This is Cork, News, Music, and Civics. The following is an excerpt from Democracy Now!, which aired on Friday, January 3rd, 2025. For more information on national and international news, visit democracynow.org. This is Cork.
From New York, this is Democracy Now! FBI says it's not found a link between the New Orleans and Las Vegas New Year's Day attacks. Both men served in the U.S. Army in Afghanistan. The New Orleans man was an Army veteran in the military for a decade. The Vegas suspect was an active-duty Green Beret described as an ardent Trump supporter. We'll look at what we know and don't know, and at incoming President Trump's record on homegrown terrorism. Then, three films directed by Palestinians are shortlisted for the Academy Awards. We'll look at one of them, From Ground Zero, a collection of 22 short films made by people in Gaza surviving Israel's bombings and brutal blockade.
No to injustice, no to violence, no to the violation of human rights. No to everything that goes against humanity, joy, life. No to everything that destroys our hopes.
We'll speak with From Ground Zero's curator, the renowned Palestinian filmmaker Rashid Mashrawi, as the film is set to be released today in theaters across the United States. And we'll get an update on the impact of Israel's war on Gaza in Yemen and the U.S. strikes on Yemen in the last days. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli attacks in Gaza have killed at least 35 Palestinians since dawn, with authorities reporting more than 70 civilians killed over the past 24 hours, including this in the so-called humanitarian safe zone of Al-Mawasi. This comes as the Palestinian rights group Al-Haq published a new report called How to Hide a Genocide, revealing how Israel uses evacuation orders and safe zones to obfuscate what it calls its genocidal campaign in the Gaza Strip. Al-Haq writes, quote, with insufficient space, shelter, sanitation, facilities, food or water sources, and medical care, these safe zones are intentionally designed to ensure the destruction of all life sheltering there. What's more, the safe zones are routinely targeted by Israeli occupying forces by air, land, and sea, they wrote. As the relentless attacks on Gaza continue, Israeli negotiators are reportedly heading back to Qatar to resume ceasefire talks. Here in New York, the UN Security Council is holding an emergency meeting today to discuss Israeli attacks on Gaza hospitals, including northern Gaza's Kamel Edwan Hospital, whose director, Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, was abducted last week by Israeli forces. Israel has since refused to confirm his location or his condition. Medical workers around the world have been calling for his release and for the protection of Gaza's crumbling health infrastructure. Reports on the ground in Gaza say the Israeli military is ordering the forced evacuation of Indonesian hospital, where a handful of patients that were forced out of Kamal Adwan are now being treated. Al Jazeera also reports Israeli forces are intensively shelling the vicinity of Al-Awda Hospital in central Gaza. Palestinian authorities warn 3,500 children are at risk of death due to severe malnutrition. 22% of Gaza's population is currently facing catastrophic levels of acute food insecurity. This is the displaced mother of a sick baby being treated at a UN facility in Deir al-Balah.
The reason behind my daughter's condition is displacement. We fled from the north to Rafah and then to Deir al-Balah, where we lived in a tent. My daughter's fever would reach 40 degrees daily. We took her to the American hospital every day because of the fever, and they would prescribe paracetamol before sending us away. Her malnutrition worsened due to prolonged displacement, lack of food, and financial hardship since my husband's work stopped during the war.
New Orleans' famed Bourbon Street opened for business Thursday, one day after a man crashed his pickup truck into crowds of New Year's revelers, killing at least 14 people before he was shot dead by police. Investigators now believe the assailant, the 42-year-old Shamsuddin Jabbar of Houston, Texas, acted alone. He served in the U.S. Army for over a decade, including at North Carolina's Fort Liberty, previously known as Fort Bragg. The FBI says he was inspired by the Islamic State and pledged his allegiance to the group in Facebook videos just hours before the attack. Authorities say he'd expressed plans to harm his family by gathering relatives for a celebration before deciding to attack Bourbon Street instead. The FBI has identified the driver of the Tesla Cybertruck that exploded outside the Trump International Hotel in Las Vegas Wednesday morning. Investigators say 37-year-old Matthew Leivelsberger of Colorado Springs died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head moments before his rented Cybertruck, which was packed with fireworks and fuel canisters, dramatically burst into flames. Seven people suffered minor injuries from what the FBI now believes was an intentional explosion. Leivelsberger was a decorated active duty special operations soldier attaining the rank of master sergeant in the U.S. Army. From 2017 to 2019, he served three tours of duty in Afghanistan. Before that, he was deployed to the Republic of Congo, Ukraine, and Tajikistan. Leivelsberger was on leave from his base in Germany and rented the Tesla on December 28th in Colorado Springs. FBI Special Agent Spencer Evans says investigators are still searching for a motive.
We know we have a bombing, absolutely, and it's a bombing that certainly has factors that raise concern. It's not lost on us that it's in front of, you know, of the Trump building, that it's a Tesla vehicle, but we don't have information at this point that definitively tells us or suggests it was because of this particular ideology or the, you know, any of the reasoning behind it.
The FBI says it hasn't found any association between the Cybertruck explosion and the attack in New Orleans earlier on New Year's Day. Both men served in the U.S. Army, including overlapping assignments at Fort Bragg in North Carolina, but there's no evidence that they knew each other. On Capitol Hill, the 119th U.S. Congress is opening today with Republicans' control of both the House and the Senate. For the first time ever, the U.S. Senate will have two black women serving at the same time. Angela Alsobrooks of Maryland and Lisa Blunt Rochester from Delaware, both Democrats. Republicans will hold 53 Senate seats, Democrats 47. The U.S. House will swear in its first ever openly transgender lawmaker, Sarah McBride, a Democrat from Delaware. But the fate of the House speakership remains remains uncertain. As of late Thursday, as Speaker Mike Johnson can only afford to lose one Republican vote as his party holds a slim 219 to 215 majority in the chamber. Some Republicans fear a protracted battle for House Speaker could delay the certification of Donald Trump's Electoral College victory, which is scheduled for Monday. Meanwhile, House Democrats are accusing Republicans of, quote, doubling down on their extremism, unquote, as they introduced a new rule that would only allow Republican lawmakers to force a vote on removing the House Speaker. Other proposals in the Republican Party's rules package include fast-tracking crackdowns on transgender rights, immigrants' rights, and abortion rights, dissolving the Congressional Diversity and Inclusion Office, renaming the Office of Congressional Ethics the Office of Congressional Conduct, and a bill that would sanction the International Criminal Court. President Biden Thursday awarded former Republican Congressmember Liz Cheney a Presidential Citizens Medal for her work on the House committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection. Democratic Congressmember Benny Thompson, who chaired the House committee, also received the award. Trump has threatened to retaliate against Cheney and Thompson, saying they should go to jail. Among the other 18 Presidential Citizen awardees was Mitsui Endo Tsutsumi, who received a posthumous recognition for challenging the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. A federal appeals court has struck down the Federal Communications Commission's net neutrality rules, which prevented internet service providers from throttling, blocking, or charging more for certain content. Net neutrality rules, which proponents say are critical to maintaining an open internet, were reinstated last year by the Biden administration after they were gutted by Trump's FCC chair, Ajit Pai, in 2018. But the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled Thursday the FCC lacked authority to regulate broadband internet as a utility, citing the Supreme Court's overturning in June of the Chevron Doctrine, a 40-year-old legal precedent that gave deference to government agencies over lower courts in interpreting laws and imposing regulations. Digital rights groups and FCC Chair Jessica Rosenworcel are urging lawmakers to take action to restore net neutrality through congressional action. Two Biden administration officials say the president has decided to block the $15 billion takeover of U.S. Steel by the Japanese company Nippon Steel on national security grounds. The sale is opposed by unions, including United Steelworkers, who support Biden won in 2020 after he pledged to oppose the merger. China has sanctioned dozens of U.S. weapons makers, the latest escalation of the U.S.-China trade war before Donald Trump takes office. On Thursday, China announced it had added 28 U.S. companies to an export control list and blacklisted 10 other U.S. companies from doing business in China, citing weapons sales to Taiwan. Among the affected companies are General Dynamics, Lockheed Martin, and Raytheon. On Tuesday, Chinese President Xi Jinping delivered his annual New Year's address, saying China's economy remains on course to expand by 5% in this year, despite Trump's threats of a renewed U.S.-China trade war.
The Chinese economy faces some new conditions, including challenges of uncertainties in the external environment and pressures of transformation from old growth drivers into new ones. But we can prevail with our hard work.
In South Korea, authorities suspended their attempt to arrest the impeached President Yoon Suk-yeol after a dramatic six-hour standoff with Yoon's supporters and his security forces. A court issued the arrest warrant for him earlier this week following his short-lived attempt to impose martial law last month. The warrant's valid until January 6. Yoon Suk-yeol's impeachment proceedings are set to start on January 14. At least 27 people died Thursday in two shipwrecks off the coast of Tunisia. One of the dead was a newborn baby. 83 surviving refugees from various sub-Saharan African countries were rescued by members of the Tunisian National Guard. Separately, at least 20 asylum seekers went missing Tuesday after their boat sank as it traveled from Libya to Italy. Authorities believe the passengers, which included women and children, died in the tragedy. The International Organization for Migration says at least 24,500 people have disappeared or died in the central Mediterranean since 2014 as they attempted to reach European shores. Most of the refugee boats set sail from Libya or Tunisia. And President Biden is preparing to designate two new national monuments in California ahead of Donald Trump's return to power. The Chuckwalla Monument, located next to the Joshua Tree National Park between the Colorado River and Coachella Valley, would create the largest contiguous protected area in the U.S. Biden's reportedly also announcing protections for the Satitla National Monument in Northern California near Oregon, which the Pitt River Tribe has been fighting to shield from energy development. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
That was an excerpt from Democracy Now!, which aired on Friday, January 3rd, 2025. For more information on national and international news, visit democracynow.org. This is Cork, News, Music, and Civics.